Good evening. I'm Henry Banks, senior producer and host of People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in a few moments, my conversation with school psychologist and book publisher Riquette Ciasar from St. Paul, Minnesota. We're also going to air a portion of a speech by Dr. Mary Canty Merrill in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Black Student Union Organization at UWS. And then our production assistant, Michaela, will close the show honoring significant women from our region. March is Women's History Month in America. Good evening, and thanks for joining us. This is People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On the phone today, I'm joined by Riquette Ciasar. She is a school psychologist in the Twin Cities. She is also co-owner of Papyrus Publishing, and that organization is also in the Twin Cities. She's joining me tonight. We're going to be talking about the world of publishing projects she's working on. And anything else, Riquette, you have an interest in talking to us tonight on People of Color. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Henry. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as I mentioned, you're a school psychologist. So can you tell our listeners in your day-to-day role, what are some of the things you do as a school psychologist?
Well, in my day-to-day role, you would think it sounds a lot more interesting than it sometimes end up being. But I do work directly with teachers and students and parents to try to help coordinate the learning of students based on their individual needs. So school psychology is a field that might include a lot of different things, but in the district that I'm in, a lot of my work is around assessing students to identify their needs and their areas of strength so that we can make their curriculum as close as possible suit their needs so that they can be successful in school.
So you're very busy, I would imagine.
Yes, but I am currently part-time in the school district working in that capacity.
Okay. All right. Very good. So I so appreciate you taking the time to be with me tonight. I know, as I mentioned, you're very busy. You're a co-owner of a publishing company also in the Twin Cities.
Uh-huh.
If you could share with our listeners some of the work your publishing company does, some of the authors that you've worked with, and even some of the books that you published. I believe our listeners would love to hear that.
Sure. Well, about 22 years ago, my husband and I, along with a number of community folks that we were working with, started a publishing business called Papyrus Publishing, Inc. And that was basically as a result of us both being educators and seeing the need for different curricula and different materials in terms of literary materials being available to children and adults in our community. So we started Papyrus Publishing and since have published, I think, over about maybe close to 20 titles. It's been something that we've done on the side, so it hasn't been like where we've tried to generate 100 books every year or a large number of, in terms of volumes, but we've really looked at projects that are needed to be out there for general consumption for our community and other communities that really want to know what the African American and people of African descent in the Twin Cities and in the state of Minnesota is actually doing and experiencing. So some of the titles we've published, a professor in the Twin Cities who's one of our renowned historians, Professor Mahmoud El-Khati. So he's had about four books that we have published Hiptionary was his first one that focuses on the linguistic creativity that comes from our community and how we create words to convey the meanings of things that typically aren't found in, you know, Webster's or the Merriam Dictionary. We also published The Myth of Race and the Reality of Racism, which was his last book. We've also published a number of other books. Best in Class is one of them by Eric Mahmoud, the owner and founder of one of the largest charter school, previously private school, specific for students of African descent in the Twin Cities. And we've published additional things like a couple of poets, and there have been some memoirs from elders who have wanted to get their information and their experiences out there. So those are some of the things we've published, but it's all been informational. It's been things primarily that look at the experience of Black people in the African community and look at our stories and our narratives to see how we have lived and how we are preparing our next generation to do what they need to do.
So when I hear some of the topics, specifically one, the myth of race, I've read that from front to back and from front to back again. One of the best books out there on the myth of race.
Mm-hmm.
And would you talk about the importance of having not only that book, but the importance of having African heritage or African American books and curriculum in our schools throughout Wisconsin, Minnesota, and nationally?
Oh, well, that was my latest project, because the last 3 years I've been working on a nonprofit publishing agency called In Black Ink. And In Black Ink came around because we have been really trying to look at the curricula that is in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and all the surrounding suburban areas and up outstate areas where our people reside, so that we can really generate some more of a balanced landscape in terms of a balanced view of what Minnesota looks like. Because what we found is a lot of young people don't know the stories of the people that actually live right with them. There's lots of very instrumental, not just locally in terms of statewide, but nationally and internationally known folks that have come through Minnesota that has put their stamp and their mark on this state and have contributed greatly. And so within Black Ink, we had over about, I think, 21 consultants that came together with three organizations, Papyrus Publishing, the St. Paul Almanac, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, to look at what narratives are out there for our community, for the community of African descent, because we feel like the young people are very limited in their knowledge and scope about the stories that have come before them, and there's still people living who have this information and this connection to that information in them that we really wanted to capture. So part of the plan or part of the vision has been to really motivate and mobilize our community to really look at sharing their own stories, documenting their own stories, and then publishing their own stories. Because we also looked at the publishing industry and found that part of the problem, in terms of part of the reason why we don't have as much or as many options available around stories and historical events and novels, all of the genres, the reason why we don't have as much available to not just our community, but for all communities to have more than just a single story about our people is because only 4% of the published material is published about people of African descent. And this is a slightly old statistic, and I know it's changed. I'm thinking it's closer to 6% now, but 4 or 6 is still really, really dismal.
And so that's nationally?
That's nationally. Hmm. So that the material that's published on or about people of African descent is it makes up about 4% of the market of published work.
Wow.
The people who are in leadership who do make the decision about what they publish, why it's being published, there's only about 2% of us that exist of African descent in that publishing field. So the publishing field has been, for over 20-plus years, have been making statements and constantly talking about how to diversify publishing, how to diversify stories, and how to create different images of different communities so that it's not a single story that exists about any one community. And they haven't been making a lot of headway because it keeps coming back to we're not out there, which we have found is not totally correct, because there's lots of people like myself included who have been in the publishing industry but have been on the peripheral because I can't afford to have that be my bread and butter in terms of my main job. And so there's editors that we found of color. We found over 100 and I think it was 170 something authors in the metro area alone.
In the metro area alone?
That we have found that actually have authored, and it could have been things like poetry, self-help, including all the genres. And this, our research wasn't thorough in terms of being able to lift every rock and review and find every citation, but we found that there was over 170-something authors that existed in this Twin Cities metro area, some of the surrounding areas, who have authored a piece, and that includes people like Pamela Fletcher, like Caroline Hallbrook, like Eric Mahmoud, Mahmoud El-Khati, Alan Page. I mean, there's just a lot of people that we might have heard about who have done a few things, but they've tried to put their stories in a way where it can have some longevity in our communities. And so we feel like that is the way that we help diversify the field. We have to identify these people and say that even though you think you're writing your own memoir or you're writing a story for your children or you're writing, you know, maybe poetry to express yourself so that you can work on your wholeness, this is stuff that our community wants and needs because it adds another perspective to who we are.
I'm Henry Banks. You're listening to People of Color, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm having a conversation right now with Riquette CSR. She's a school psychologist in St. Paul. I'm with Riquette CSR. She's on the phone from the Twin Cities. She's a school psychologist and co-owner of Papyrus Publishing, also in the Twin Cities. You know, the need is so great, especially right now in the climate that we're living in. Our kids alone aren't getting this information, as you've alluded to, and they're missing out on a whole bunch of stuff that they really need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Henry, I want to stress that even though Papyrus Publishing was one of the first Black-owned, we had the marketing person we worked with was of African descent. The everyone on our team was of African descent. Our business was a for-profit, kind of like a small mom-and-pa type business. And the piece that we're really trying to develop now is In Black Ink.
Mm-hmm.
So In Black Ink is the current and we haven't been calling it a publishing company because it's a publishing initiative. We want to enhance publishing or people who are in that publishing field in the state of Minnesota, so that the young people who are interested in writing can see themselves as authors, or those who are really good at editing and proofing can see themselves in those fields, as well as desktop publishers, graphic artists. Our first project that we actually did was funded last year by the Historical Society to produce a book series for the Rondo community area. And Henry, I know, I don't know like how much you know about the Rondo area. I know you're all the way in Duluth.
Right. I know a little bit about it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the Rondo area it's a really important community in the state of Minnesota for people of African descent, because that's where most people of African descent was designated to back in the early 50s and the 40s, 50s, 60s. That's where we were designated to. But I've talked with many people across the state who do remember there was always some mixture of folks in every community that we existed. But at the same time, when you look at the numbers of people of African descent in that region, it was over 60% of us. We lived, over 60% of the black people that lived in the state of Minnesota lived in the Rondo area during that period of time.
And I know I've talked to elders in Duluth and in Superior, Wisconsin also, and they're very aware of the Rondo neighborhood. And The first thing they tell me is the freeway went through and separated the neighborhood. And so there was that as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's not just specific to our state, because we have found out that this has happened across the nation in many states, in many communities. Freeways were purposely put through less desirable areas, which were primarily occupied by people of African descent or other people of color. So in those areas, when we look at the Rondo community was disrupted when the Interstate 94 came through and basically separated people from one side of the bridge to the other side, one side of the freeway to the other side. So neighbors who used to be able to walk those blocks up and down and see each other were no longer next door to each other. They couldn't see each other. They couldn't get across unless you go to certain designated areas, which was built after the fact. So it was very difficult for people to remain connected. The other thing that I've learned and was told was there was high ownership in terms of homes, and people who were displaced from their homes were not compensated so that they could move to another area where they can find another space where they could actually enjoy the fruits of their labor in terms of home ownership. Mm-hmm. So a lot of homes were destroyed. The state has since apologized to the Rondo community and have committed to building bridges, literally and figuratively, to help reconnect the community so that they can rebuild the community and at the same time provide opportunities for people who may have had to migrate due to that moving in of the Interstate 94 so they can come back. There's a Return to Rondo initiative being done currently. There's the Rondo Bridge that they're working on, and with that there's several pieces of work that's instrumentally being done around Rondo at this time. And a year and a half ago, we received funding to produce a book series.
I was getting ready to ask you about that book series.
Yeah. Oh, go I had an accent.
So I didn't mean to cut you off there, but was on my mind. The Rondo series is 8 books, if I'm, mm-hmm. am I correct on that?
Yes, the intent is to have 8 books. We currently, we were funded to complete 2, and so we're moving to trying to get the remaining 6 completed. The first 2 that we completed, what we did was we identified, well, first, the concept and the idea came out of an elder who lived, who was born and raised in the Rondo area and currently lives there. He went away and returned home and has been instrumental in starting Rondo Days. He's one of Marvin Anderson, starting Rondo Days, and now he's one of the lead community folks who is working with the state on the Rondo Bridge that will be built, I think, in 2020 or 2021, they're estimated. But he had developed, along with several other community members, 8 values that he felt came out of the experience of living and being raised in the Rondo community. Things like hard work, community connection, in terms of the community basically took care of each other. A lot of the men worked on the railroad, therefore a lot of the women then formed lots of different clubs, which appeared like, you know, just almost, it appeared like clubs, but what they were ways for them to provide health care for each other, for them to be able to bring food to each other if, you know, with one family father or the husband was away for a longer period of time. The women got together. They know who was sick, who needed help with what, and they basically organized the community to provide the needs of the community amongst themselves. And so that was huge, just the whole piece about hard work and then community and family. He also included values like spirituality, religion, belief, and entrepreneurship, and just a series of 8 values which he wanted books to be created around to help share the experience with the younger generation. Because although the younger people have been coming to things like Rondo Days for years, which is they see as a festival slash parade slash there's usually tons of things happening on that day, but most people never understood why it actually happened, why it was instituted, and how it was connected to the community that spawned it. And so part of what Elder Marvin Anderson wanted to do was be able to have stories that share some of this knowledge with the young people and help them to see that it wasn't just something that happened in the past. Rondo has created people that live these values, and these are things that they try to raise their children with, and this is how they've been trying to build their community, and he wants those things to live again.
I'm Henry Banks. You're listening to People of Color, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm having a conversation right now with Riquette CSR. She's a school psychologist in St. Paul.
Part of what he requested was for In Black Ink to identify ways for us to create 8 stories to tell these stories about their experience. And we've identified young people who are writers in the community who have been raised or connected to the Rondo area. And we identified artists who are also from that area. And they have helped to produce the first 2 stories, which is the first one was Mr. Rondo, Mr. Rondo's Spirit, a story of a man in his community, and the second was Joey and Grandpa Johnson's Day in Rondo.
I own 2 copies. I have a copy of each of those books, and they are absolutely fantastic books.
Great.
Yeah, and so what I'd like to do is I'm going to be sharing those books. I've already shared them with the public libraries around here, and they're likely going to be ordering the books. But
wonderful.
Also with our school districts here, they need to consider putting those books in their library or in their curriculum at some point.
That is wonderful. You know, one of our partners through this process has been the Minnesota Humanities Center, and they initially, after the publication of the book, ordered a large amount and have gifted them to, I think it's been a total of maybe 8 to 10 schools in the metro area, mm-hmm. that's around the Rondo area. They wanted the schools in the Rondo area to have the books available for the students. And so that has been really good. Actually, one of the schools called at the end of the year and have been trying to do a Rondo conference. And so there's a Rondo conference coming up before the end of the month of March. I think it's March 25th, 26th, and 27th at their school, and it's an elementary school. So what they organized was they wrote a grant that allowed them to pay the artists and the authors to come in and talk about the process that they went through with the writing and the creating of the stories, share the stories with the students, and do some activities. And they also have been able to provide some stipends to the elders to come in and talk about their community experience. So that has been a blessing. And I would encourage, you know, all schools to look at something like that where they can engage the community and these authors and the artists in a way where it helps them to see that, you know, the community is reading and understanding, because the books actually, they're supposed to be children's books, but I've been told by many adults, they're actually adult or family books.
They're wonderful. So, they cross the whole entire spectrum.
Thank you, Henry.
They really do. And you know, I wanted to mention to you earlier, you were talking about graphic artists and, you know, talented folks of that nature. We have a graphic artist, a husband and wife team that have their own business up here in Duluth called Blackbird Revolt.
Ooh.
And they produce some remarkable graphic art. They're super talented people. So I should make a connection with them and with you, possibly.
Definitely.
Because, you know, they really are gifted.
I wrote the name down. If you can make a connection, I would love that.
Okay.
Because that's part of what, that was one of the charges for In Black Ink as well. Well, we said that we're tired of the industry talking about we don't exist. And so in trying to create a database that actually housed the creative artists in terms of graphic, illustrative, as well as the literary and all other types of individuals who work and is connected to the publication of an item, we wanted to have that be on a database. We're just in the process of completing our website, and we actually will have to add the database. It'll have the capacity for us to do that, but we'll have to add that as we go, because the cost was a little beyond what we were able to afford at this time as we're starting out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of our goals, or one of our main goals as well, to create a database where you can access artists of African descent, illustrators of African descent, you know, graphic editors, all of those fields or those areas where typically the publishing industry has a hard time finding, or there might be just a couple currently that's employed and continue to get those particular gigs, which is good. We want to support all our people, but we want the industry to know that there's more than two artists, there's more than two authors, there's more than two, you know, literary agents that exist that are from our community that can represent us.
Absolutely.
And we want that to be available to us.
So those listening to our show tonight, how do they get in touch with you if they're interested in possibly contributing to In Black Ink or wanting to get involved with the work of In Black Ink? How might they contact you?
They can email or message me. We have a Facebook page. A lot of people access us through there because they can see kind of generally what we've been doing, get some background on who we are until our website is up. So if they can find us at In Black Ink on Facebook, or they can email me at mninblackink@gmail.com, and mninblackink is all one at gmail.com, or they can call. I am typically available and will respond within a day.
Okay. So are we able to put your number on our Facebook page if people are interested?
Sure.
You don't mind that? Okay.
I don't mind that.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners? Because my goal here is to share with our listeners that we are available out there in a variety of different genres and work, and that work is a value in our African heritage community, always has been, always will be, because that's who we are as people.
Well, I just want to share. I think we are definitely looking at not being the, like I mentioned, the publishing agency in the Twin Cities or in the metro area or in the state of Minnesota. We're looking at encouraging others to get into publishing. I know most people feel like electronics is the new, you know, way to go, and ebooks, and there's lots of research that currently show that ebooks are not doing as well as previously thought, because people really like the feel of a book in their hand.
Right.
So they're not going to be obsolete anytime soon. We have a number of organizations that have been very good to us and have been very supportive, and will be opening a new location in terms of an office space in St. Paul, in the Selby Avenue, in the Rondo area, in the next month, actually. So we'd love to have people, you know, just look us up and stop in and visit us. But over this next year, we have a couple of really important projects that'll be coming up, and we want people to really seek it out. We're looking at, we have 9 contributors to a book that will be coming out before the end of the year, called Towards an African Education. It's local educators, literary folks who are interested in what does it take to teach, and how do you provide a culturally based, as well as add some diverse thoughts to the teaching of children of African descent and all other children, because we don't think just like we learn everybody else's history, I think everybody has to learn our history and learn about us, because that's how we as people grow. We create memories together and stories together so that we can learn how to how other people see the world. So we have that piece that will be publication that will be coming out before the end of the year, as well as a publication about an elder who was really instrumental also in the again in the St. Paul area, St. Paul, Minneapolis area, named Kofi Bobby Hickman. His book will be coming out before the end of this year as well.
Yeah, so that's exciting. That's good news. That's really good news.
So just look us up, call, inquire. Emailing is a great way to get a hold of me, and Facebook, messaging me on Facebook, that's a wonderful way. If there's connections or contacts that you think we should know about, we'd love to. We've been in the Duluth area, and we love you guys for all the work you're doing, especially Henry. We really are proud of, you know, just the work that you continue to do.
Thank you for that.
And want to see the work that you've done and your archivals and things that you've collected shared across the state and eventually nationally, because the work that you're doing, even in connection with the Jackson McGee Clayton Memorial,
yes,
has really been something that has created a stepping stone for a lot of other communities. And I think it's just something that we really have to keep an eye on, and we have to encourage people to continue to collect this information about our experience.
Absolutely.
Place and time.
Right. So thank you very much. And I know you're very busy, and I just wanted to get this opportunity to have this conversation to share with our listeners about the important work going on throughout the state of Minnesota and other parts of the country. Way up here in Wisconsin, we're doing some work.
You are.
They're doing great work down in the Twin Cities. And so we need to keep getting this message out that our community values so much education, family, work ethics. Everything about our community is good.
Yes.
It's good, and we need to share the goodness of our community with others.
Exactly.
So,
thank you so much for this opportunity, Henry.
Have a great evening.
You do the same.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color. We're going to present to you now a portion of a speech by Dr. Mary Canty Merrill, who was recently in Superior, Wisconsin for the 50th anniversary of the Black Student Union at UWS.
This is not the time to gaslight. It's not the time to assert your privilege. And this is not the time for you to say, I know better than you know, because no, you don't always know. Young people have something to say, and it is incumbent upon us to hear what they have to say. One of the things that I've discovered is that in this role that I play in working with organizations, I'm often interacting with a lot of people who are at the leadership level of the organization. And these are people who, needless to say, generally feel like, you know, since I am the president or the executive director or the chancellor or the provost or whomever it is at this point, then I know best and what I say goes. Now, as a consultant, I can tell you generally the individual who considers themselves to be in the leadership role, when they call me in to consult, the issue that they tell me, oh, this is the problem we're having, almost always is not really what the issue is. Sometimes the issue is them. They're in the leadership role, but they are squashing the voices of those who come after. So stop talking, stop gaslighting, stop second guessing, and listen. Listen, really, really actively pay attention so that you know not just what is going on, but that you can understand the nature of what the situation is and what a person is encountering, and that you can offer empathy, that you can offer understanding, that you can be compassionate, that you can serve as a mentor, that you can serve as a coach. Listen. One of the things that I'd like to say too is that people of color, we have a right to be angry. There goes that black, angry black woman again. You're darn right I'm angry. Living in this time, this day and time, and being confronted with the things that we're being confronted with, we have a right, we have every right to be angry. And we have a right to demonstrate our moral outrage. And that shows up in various ways. It could be through advocacy. It could also be through activism. But one of the things about the anger is I like to be able to use that to propel me to make a change. Not in a deconstructive way, but in a constructive manner, to take that anger, to take that outrage, and use that to make and to impact and make a change. Another thing an advocate must do is to raise awareness. Awareness leads to engagement. Awareness leads to engagement, and engagement leads to action. And action leads to advocacy. If you cannot raise awareness, then you cannot address the issue at hand. Now, let me give you an example of awareness that could be raised, but it's one of those things that people tend to overlook. Young people today, for example, they're exposed to these mass shootings in schools, and not only in schools, but where have you. And so rather than talk about the real issue of what is causing individuals to engage in these mass shootings, one of the things that folk really, really don't want to talk about is the anger and the violence and the hatred that has been perpetuated by white males in the society, and they still do not want to call it domestic terrorism. It is domestic terrorism. And some people might get upset about that, but that's okay, because I'm going to say that while I'm here. But until you address the root cause of these issues and raise awareness around those issues, it's like the height of insanity, doing the same things over and over again, the same way, and expecting a different result. That is the height of insanity. And I'm not here to pick on anybody, but I am here to bring truth. And you have to be able to acknowledge and recognize when we are dealing with or not dealing with the issue, you can't gloss over the issue and expect to make any kind of change. You must handle and confront issues head on. Somebody could even say amen if you want to. Another thing that an advocate must do is to ask powerful questions. And what I mean by asking powerful questions is asking questions that is going to elicit useful information in order for you to better assess a situation as well as devise viable interventions to address the situation. Rather than just ask a person, "Are you okay?" that is going to elicit either a yes or no response. A better question would be, "Tell me how you're doing today. Tell me how you're feeling. What are you struggling with? What is keeping you up at night?" These are questions that will give you more insight to gain a better understanding and a better awareness of the situation, the reality of the situation. Another thing that an advocate must do, an effective advocate, is to bring publicity to amplify your message. We all have access to media. We have access to print media, we have access to the press, we have access to social media. It's to bring the media so that they can spread the word, so that they can get the information out there. And all of this goes back to being able to understand fact, to know fact from fallacy. So that when you provide the information to the media, you're giving them accurate information for them to communicate and articulate on your behalf. If you do not do that, what you run the risk of is creating chaos instead of constructive processes. So bring the media in, but use them in a way that is going to help to advance your cause rather than to create chaos or to cause it to derail your cause. Another thing an advocate must do is to identify your points of leverage. There are many points of leverage that you can tap into. You can tap into organizations who are also proponents of the same cause that you have. You also have access, and you can tap into the influential individuals in your community. You can also access and tap into the skills, resources, talents of young people, as well as the community, and whomever it is that will be able to help you to advance your cause and reach collective impact. Another essential leverage point of the digital media is something that we witnessed recently with the Parkland students. After the shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School down in Parkland, Florida, we witnessed students actually rise up. And when students rise up, they can really do some amazing things. But what we have to do is get out of the way and stop being an impediment to allowing them to help make change. Now, a lot of us, and I say us too because I would consider myself, I've come further than I have to go in this life. So when we step aside, some of you have, in a leadership capacity, you have dug a rut, comfortably furnished that rut, and you are comfortably relaxing in that rut. There are a few things that you are doing to really make change. Oh yeah, you're pontificating, hey, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but in some cases you aren't doing a thing. It is imperative that if you are going to be in the fast lane, you need to be providing and making some speed. If you're not going to produce, get out of the way and let somebody come in that's really going to make a change. I was in Germany last year, and those of you who are familiar with Germany, you're probably familiar with the Autobahn. These are folks that are driving in the fast lane, and they're doing 100 and some odd miles an hour. And you dare not get in that lane driving 55, 60, or even 70, because you will end up somewhere with your wheels up in the air. So if you are in the fast lane and you are not producing, you are an impediment to progress. You must. It is incumbent upon you, if you are an activist, an advocate, for you to be able to produce, to make a difference. Now, I've talked about advocacy, and one of the things I'm gonna do now is just kind of shift over and talk about activism. What exactly does an activist do?
To listen to highlights from the 50th anniversary of the Black Student Union and Dr. Merrill's entire speech, go to WPR/POC and click on the March 7, 2019 link. That's March 7, 2019, and you'll get to hear highlights from the 50th anniversary of the Black Student Union organization on the UWS campus and Dr. Merrill's entire speech. We're going to take a moment here. Michaela is our production assistant, and she's going to be at this time talking about some key and important people from our community and also from our region who have been on People of Color. They are making major contributions in our area, in our region, and in our world, and we wanted to just take time to honor each of them for Women's History Month.
Burkett CSR is a school psychologist and small business owner making a tremendous difference in the lives of children in the Minneapolis-St. Paul School District, publishing several books under the Papyrus label. She is currently a leader in a statewide organization called In Black Ink, publishing books by, for, and about the African heritage community. Dr. Joki Kamau has been a longtime University of Minnesota Duluth professor, and she is from Kenya. She does extensive work in gender and sexuality studies and is an expert in those areas. Dr. Mary Canty Merrill is a nationally known psychologist and business owner who owns her own consulting firm, working with Fortune 500 companies from all over the U.S. in the areas of race, racism, human rights, and civil rights. Teresa Moses is a local business owner and professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. The company she co-owns is making an enormous impact in the region, addressing race and social injustice through her business, art, and teaching. Heidi Bach-Hansen is an educator in the areas of racism and lynching, examining the impact those lynchings have had in the U.S. Sandra Oyen-Loye is a local businesswoman and educator in the area of creativity, using poetry, music, and art as her medium. Leah Carr is the assistant director of the American Indian Learning Resource Center at the University of Minnesota Duluth. She is an elder in the Native American community and has worked with thousands of students over the years at UMD. Anika Robbins is a small business owner in Minneapolis and president of the Anika Foundation, which aims to connect individuals with community organizations for positive change. Sharon Witherspoon is a longtime resident in Duluth, Minnesota, and Sharon has provided advocacy support for the last 30 years to the region. Babette Sandman is an elder in the Native American community and currently a member of the Duluth Indigenous Commission. In that capacity, she advocates for the rights and culture of the Native American community. Sally Findey is a grants analyst for the Leech Lake Band of the Ojibwe and an expert in Ojibwe culture and heritage. As we close the show today, we take this time to honor these important women who continue to make a difference in the lives of the people of our community, our region, and our world. This list is in no way comprehensive, and we thank all of the women who support our show and our community.
I'm Victor Martinez of Pinnacle Point Studios in Duluth, and I listen to People of Color with Henry Banks for news and information important to my community. Listen to People of Color with Henry Banks every Thursday at 6 p.m. on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.